This is Radioactive, a weekly grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for March 27, 2014. This is Meredith DeFrancesco. Today we look at the movement to raise the nation's minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. And we look again at the Wabanaki tribe's struggles to maintain sovereignty over water and fishing rights. On Monday, an 11-state bus tour promoting a bill to raise the federal minimum wage kicked off in Bangor, Maine. The tour, organized by Americans United for Change, is traveling to Washington, D.C., arriving just prior to the expected Senate vote on the Fair Minimum Wage Act, sponsored by Senators Miller and Harkins, which would bring the federal minimum wage up from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour. The bill would also require the rate to be indexed for inflation each year and would increase the rate for tipped workers by a certain percentage. A full-time minimum wage employee earning $7.25 an hour makes $15,000 annually. In 2014, the poverty level is just over $23,000 a year for a family of four. For a single person, the level is $11,670. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports in 2012, 3.6 million workers in the U.S. worked for wages at or below the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. In January, President Obama announced a minimum wage increase of $10.10 for federally contracted workers. And yesterday, Connecticut's Senate and House passed a bill raising their state minimum wage to $10.10 an hour by 2017. Maine's minimum wage stands at $7.50 an hour. At each stop, the Time for a Raise bus tour highlights local proponents for raising the minimum wage. At their first stop in Bangor on a cold morning last Monday, Congressman Mike Michaud spoke along with others from the area and those making the full tour.
It's time to raise the minimum wage. They know that it will save money and decrease government spending on food and nutritional programs, home heating oil, school lunches, and child care. Raising the minimum wage is good for families, it's good for our state, and it's good for our country. Raising the minimum wage, raising the minimum wage is common sense. Americans who put in an honest day's work deserves an honest day's pay. The time is now. The time is now to give America a raise. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman. Thank you.
The Principal Deputy Administrator for the U.S. Department of Labor, Laura Fortman, spoke as well. She is also on the 18-stop, 11-state, Give America a Raise bus tour. Fortman served as the Commissioner of the Maine Department of Labor from 2003 to 2011 and also served as the Director of the Francis Perkins Center in Maine.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be back home in Maine and also to do a little reminder about the minimum wage. It was first passed in 1938. And one of the key drivers for that was someone with deep Maine roots, Francis Perkins. Since 1938, the minimum wage has been raised over 20 times in a bipartisan manner by both Republican presidents and Democratic Congresses. People have worked together. And the reason for that, as you've already heard, is it has a huge impact on people's lives. These are more than just statistics. These are people who are struggling, and they're adults. Frequently, we hear about minimum wage, and folks say, oh, it's only a first job. It's only teenagers. 88% of the people who are earning the minimum wage are age 20 and over. The average age is 35. These are people who are supporting themselves and their families. That money goes directly back into the economy. That extra few thousand dollars will help people feed their families, also, you know, buy school clothes for the kids and support the local economy. As has already been said a number of times, no one should be working full-time in America and living in poverty. I'm delighted to be standing with these people today to demonstrate the importance of the minimum wage increase.
One of the main opposition points that you hear, particularly from Republicans, about an increase in minimum wage is that will hurt business. Well, not all business agrees. There are many businesses that have already increased or have a higher minimum wage than the federal minimum wage, or have increased to 1010. Our next speaker, Sean Garceau, knows the feeling. He's a manager at Miguel's Mexican Restaurant here in Bangor, a local small business. I've already been called out on that once. That knows fairness is good for the bottom line. I mean, we know if the minimum wage is increased, people have more disposable income, they spend more money. It's good. It's good for everyone. Miguel's announced in January that their non-tip staff was going to start at a base wage of $10.10 an hour. So they've already increased their minimum wage. Let's hear it. Let's bring up Sean.
Hi, everybody. I work at Miguel's Mexican Restaurant. We at Miguel's always supported paying a regular rate for our hourly employees. After the President's State of Union address, we decided to take a step further and act now than rather waiting on Congress. We raised our base rate of pay for our regular hourly employees to $10.10 an hour. We did this back on January 31st, and our doors are still open, so it doesn't, you know. We are independently owned and feel it's up to small businesses like us not to wait. We should act now. We feel strongly that this pay needed to survive in today's market of ever-increasing prices and basic necessities. Our employees should be able to work and afford for pay for things like rent, food, bills, and maybe even a little leftover to go shopping or take the families out to dinner. We already hear staff talking about going out to dinner, having a date night, surprise their wives or husbands with a gift or their significant other. We're not saying that's happening, wasn't happening all before, but I can't remember the frequency that it happened. You know, it's so much better. We feel strongly that raising minimum wage is not the only fair thing to do, but also good for the growing economy. It puts more money in the hands of people who need it the most. There's no reason why larger companies can't afford to do the same, get their workers off state programs, and let our tax dollars towards programs that we're intended for. Help push this movement for business owners, and I think we should all just act now, get it all done.
Great, thank all you. Right. Thank you, sir. All right, last but definitely not least, you know, there is there's an economic case to be made, as Sean has mentioned. There's a fairness case. There's the issue of income equality and wages. There's also a moral case. Now, I'm honored to introduce Reverend Becky Gunn. She's a minister at the Unitarian Universalist Society of Bangor, and she works in the ministry, including soup kitchens and other social services and outreach. And she is brought face-to-face with too many Mainers who are working hard as they can, yet still can't make ends meet. Let me bring up Reverend Becky Gunn. Thank you so much.
Raising the minimum wage is a moral imperative. The current minimum wage is a wage that keeps people in poverty even though they work. It is morally wrong for companies to make a profit from an individual's work when that work is paid so poorly that he or she cannot provide their families with shelter, food, and clothing. As a woman of faith, as a Unitarian Universalist minister, I believe in equity and justice. If we are to achieve a country where we each have the opportunity to thrive, where all are allowed a chance to improve their lives, we must pay those who work a living wage. If we care about our fellow humans, if we care about our values as a society, those values being freedom and the possibility of living fully, if we want to encourage increased participation in our democratic society, we need to provide a wage that rewards work. If we are to love our neighbor, we sure enough want him or her to be able to feed and clothe and house their family. If one is scrabbling to survive, one has little time to improve their lives by educating themselves or by participating politically or religiously in society. I believe that raising the minimum wage is a moral issue. Across all faiths, we are urged to love our neighbors as ourselves. One way of doing that is raising the minimum wage to above the poverty level. Today, I urge those in our national legislature to pass the Fair Minimum Wage Act now.
Because of the frigid cold and the number of interviews Congressman Michaud had given already outside, we stepped into a place of business to speak further, hence the lowered voices. We asked the congressman and Democratic candidate for governor why he thinks it's important to raise the minimum wage in the country and in Maine.
It's extremely imperative that we raise the minimum wage in this country because people who are on the minimum wage are living in poverty. The fact that when you look at Maine, Maine's minimum wage is 25 cents higher than the national average. But, you know, our minimum wage, when you adjust for inflation, we're back to what it was 40 years ago. So people are living in poverty. For a individual living and earning the minimum wage, their annual wage is $15,600. You know, that's not much. That's not much. And I think it's important for us to raise it at the federal level. If you look at it around the states, individual states have different minimum wages. And if you raise that at the federal level, at least it'll bring the whole country up to, the 10-10, which I think is a good thing to do.
Can you talk about the numbers we're looking at who are being affected by this minimum wage right now?
Yeah, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, if we were to raise the minimum wage at the national level at $10 an hour, that will lift over 900,000 people out of poverty nationally.
We often hear about those who are on government programs or receiving some sort of government assistance that they are not working. It can be the general message we hear, particularly from the governor of the state right now. Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, if you look at if we raise the minimum wage, it actually would cut food stamps expenditures nationally by the tune of $4.6 billion per year. You know, that's significant, and that shows how people are living in poverty. And we got to realize the economy is not doing well. Yes, the unemployment has gone down, but that doesn't mean people are employed. It means people are no longer counted as being unemployed because they no longer receive their unemployment benefits. So the number is lower than what it really is. So people are really hurting. And if you look at the American people, the polling number has been constantly in the 60s. As far as right now, 63% of the American people want to see an increase in the minimum wage. They know that people are out there struggling. And even though the minimum wage hasn't gone up, the price of fuel, the price of oil, food, everything's gone up significantly except for the wages.
And so can you talk about this movement at the federal level, this move to try to raise the minimum wage? What is stopping it? Where is that movement right now?
Right now on the House side, it's Republican leadership stopping it. We want the Speaker to be able to bring it to the floor for a vote. So Republicans and Democrats can vote whichever way they want on increasing the minimum wage. He's refused to do so. I think it's important to give us an opportunity to vote for it. The Senate's going to be dealing with it, it's my understanding, probably in April sometime. Hopefully the Senate will pass it, and then we can move on and put more pressure on the House leadership to bring it up for a vote. And this doesn't have to be a partisan issue. When I was president of the Maine Senate, we increased the minimum wage in a two-tiered system that went underneath the hammer in the state Senate. We sent it on to Governor King to sign that legislation. So it doesn't have to be a partisan issue. Unfortunately, Republican leadership on the House side is refusing to allow us to have a vote on the bill.
We hear a lot people talk about the plight of the middle class, and oftentimes people don't talk about the plight of those who are considered the lowest income. Can you talk about the importance of paying attention, as you've just been laying out, to those who are in the lowest income bracket in our state?
Well, I think we have to pay attention, to everyone, the low in the middle class. We are losing a middle class. And when you look at poverty issues, the fact that Maine, according to national statistics, when you look at homelessness in this country, has gone down nationally on average. In Maine, it's gone up 26%. And that's because this governor and his failed policies is ripping out, taking out the safety net out from underneath these people who need the help. And when you look at poverty issues, I think all too often the governor talks about getting people off the couch, getting them to work. Well, it'd be good if there was work out there. And there's two ways of getting people off the welfare. One, kicking them off like this governor's doing. Or the second is to make the programs more effective. For instance, if you have two parents who are both unemployed, that four kids are getting food stamps, TANF, general assistance funding, there's a job that's available, but the job doesn't pay what it really would need to pay for them to get them out of poverty. But if they took that job, they'd lose health care for their kids. What are they going to do? They're not going to take it, because they want to make sure their kids are taken care of. So if we can actually have a system that looks at poverty and encourage them to get off by saying, yes, you can take the job and you will not lose all of your benefits, have a tier-type system, that's something that the legislature and the governor definitely should be looking at to try to help people get off to get a job versus kicking them off, which drives them into homelessness.
Again, that was Congressman Mike Michaud. You are listening to Radioactive on your community radio station, WERU. We now turn again to an issue we will revisit in greater detail on future programming. It is the issue of the state of Maine's relationship with the Wabanaki tribes and the state's recent maneuvering to reinterpret treaties and the 1980 Claims Settlement Act to diminish tribal sovereignty in relation to water and fishing rights. Over the past decade alone, the Penobscot and Passamaquoddy specifically have come head-to-head with the state over the issue of pollution discharge permit jurisdiction. In a current court case, the Penobscot Nation versus Maine's Attorney General, the Penobscot Nation is attempting to reaffirm their sovereignty over fishing in their tribal waters and find themselves re-arguing their treaty rights over ownership of the river passing through their tribal lands. The state's law firm, Pierce Atwood, has now enlisted a number of towns and businesses on the Penobscot River to become so-called interveners in the case. The firm argues that the case's outcome could affect the intervener's ability to discharge pollutants into the river. The current issue for the Passamaquoddy tribe also involves their fisheries and their sovereignty. After long negotiations with the state to come to an agreement that involved recognizing that the tribe's ELVER regulations were protective of the fishery and allowed tribal autonomy, in the 11th hour, Maine's Attorney General shut down the agreement, citing conflicts with the state constitution's Equal Protection Clause. The Passamaquoddy tribe's own management plan has put a limit on overall catch, but allowed anyone in the tribe to fish. They argue that this management plan is more protective than the state's permit system. Last April, the LePage administration issued an ultimatum which resulted in the numerous arrests of Passamaquoddy tribal members fishing with tribal licenses. Vera Francis was one of the three Wabanaki scholars to speak at the Passamaquoddy Tribal Center at Sepayuk last week as part of a speaker series on the history and current conflicts with Wabanaki treaties. Francis is a member of the Passamaquoddy Fisheries Committee. This was part of her presentation.
I'm Vera Francis, and I was invited to speak with this group now a second time. So thank you for inviting me back to speak within this series, and also that I'm in such great company. I really do want to just bring our attention back to who we are, and it's a little bit of a review of Beskidamukkari. And so we heard a little bit about the treaties and a particular period of treaty time, treaty making time for us, and then as well as a very significant event that occurred with the Maine Indian land claim. So I just wanted to also bring us back to this, because that's a lot of what we're in the fisheries committee is focused on. We heard a little bit about the division of the land claims and how that was parsed out from a larger claim to be a very minimal amount of claim, and then somewhat of the interrelatedness of our territories, with our the Penobscot and the Abenaki was mentioned, as well as the Maliseet and Mi'kmaq. So for us, the Beskamukarik are part of a larger also system, natural system, that's informed us for a long period of time. And I just want to preface what I have to say with that, because we have to keep that in perspective because of what these natural systems that have influenced us greater in such great ways over a long period of time. And it, I believe, is literally just embedded in, placed in our DNA and in our memory, because how could we forget that? Because I think that we're informed by that. But the territory or the range, our historic range, our habitat, our waterways, you know, it includes what's today called the Bay of Fundy, which is one of the most dynamic systems that controls not just Passamaquoddy Bay, Clubskook Bay. It also influences and impacts the whole Gulf of Maine and all of those systems, including the Schoodick, the St. Croix. The Passamaquoddy River is also influenced by that system. And that's the range. That's the places where we are ourselves familiar with, but have over time been so restricted and literally limited by what and where and who can do what, who can fish. It does greatly disturb me that when we do get up and we stand up and we do come up with some device, you know, some management device, it's called, for here it's called the Passamaquoddy Management Fisheries Plan. You know, they said, well, if you don't have a plan, you have to follow our plan. So now we have a plan, and that plan really literally is law, has been made law now for a couple of years. And even before that time, we had also customary law, which a lot of people often ignore. And we know those things through what Andrea was talking about was through our relationships. You know, because a lot of those things are important to us, our relationships with each other, and how we are guided by that priority of relationship. So it's no wonder we treat it, because we very value relationships. And more so, though, because we also wanted to make sure that those relationships were guided by certain principles, so that those principles would ensure our existence, because though we might not have a right to exist, we might not have a right to anything, but we do certainly do exist, we do certainly do have habitat, and that we do have a right to that in a universal sense. We have a universal sense of right that we all share, and that is to exist, that is to a habitat, and that is to also recreate. But we don't hold that as ourselves, just Beskamukari or Wulustuki. We hold that in common with all of the beings. And that's why I was invited. That's why I sit on the Fisheries Management Advisory Committee. Because we hold those also in common and with equality with Wutta Namas. We hold that in common with all life's beings. And that's what guides us. That's the difference from a society that views us as having lost everything, as having surrendered, that have we lost something? I would say that we have not lost anything, but we have exercised with great care. And I did fish, and I do fish, and I did partake in the fishery last year. But over 60 people, was it? 60 tribal members? 63-ish?
Almost 70.
Almost 70. 65. So 65 to 70. Beskamukari. Most of them young. Majority of them young. majority of them very young with families, small families, and trying to make their way in life and also do something that they wanted to do. Most of them also women. Passamaquoddy women went out. Even after this had been imposed on the tribe. Imposed, I say, imposed because it was an act, it was called Mercy Act, an act to cap certain marine resources, marine licenses issued by the Passamaquoddy tribe. It was a special law for us to cap, to cap the tribe's authority to issue unlimited license, which is what it chose to do. Even after being told you could only have 124 fike or dip, you could only have 26 with a dual gear, and you can only have 50 dip nets on the Scudic, on the St. Croix. And over 500 of those were issued last year. And I think I was like 538 or something like that. And so many of these folks here, these young people, fell in that category. So in other words, they went out and fished because they believed in the tribe's ability to govern itself. And they believed in the tribe's authority that would allow them to go out and fish and access and participate and maybe make some money, but not in the same way everybody else was making the money. So what they got was a piece of paper. They got a piece of paper, and on that paper it said that it was issued by the Passamaquoddy tribe for them to go and fish a little baby eel. A magnificent, magnificent being. I don't know if you went out there, but you learned really quickly just how magnificent this being is. And if you had gone out and then watched the young people fish and hold those eels, because you can't just fish, we're taking the fish and we're also putting the fish somewhere and you're keeping them alive. You cannot let them die. And they would hold them and they would, and I believe they changed the way these brokers was buying these eels because they would not let them squeeze them. They held them. I think they changed the way that that industry had to deal with us as a group. I watched this time and time again. And everybody, I don't know about all of us, but most of us, from what I could see, everybody knew how to fish the seal, knew how to take care of it, and knew the importance of its life being, and treated it with as much respect as possible. Because that's what happens when you're able to have access, because that's what all it said, that we have a right to access. That's all it said. Access the land, not 10%, not only 124 of us, not only 200 of us, but all of us, 100%.
Again, that was Vera Francis of the Passamaquoddy tribe at Sepayuk. We will continue coverage of this issue on future programs. And you've been listening to Radioactive, a weekly environmental and social justice news journal. You can listen to archives of this and other locally produced public affairs programming at weru.org.